This is the second day of this December 2007 four-day Sesshin. And we'll go back to our text from yesterday. The book is called The Original Face, an Anthology of Rinzai Zen. And in this first of the masters, that were first chapter we're reading, is by Chinese master Chinese name is Lan Shi Daolong, who lived in the 1200s. In Japan, he's known as Daikaku. We left off yesterday where he said, the enlightened mind has no attachment to appearances. Detachment from appearances is the character of reality. Among the four modes of conduct, walking, standing, sitting, and lying, sitting is considered to be stable and tranquil. This means sitting straight and contemplating the characteristics of reality. That is actually one Buddhist practice, it's not Zen, where you actually reflect on suffering, impermanence, and no self. But has a different meaning in Zen. Contemplating the characteristics of reality means something else. The question then, please explain in detail the meaning of sitting straight and contemplating reality. Lan Shi says, sitting straight means sitting cross-legged as the Buddhas do. Contemplating reality means sitting meditation. Forming the symbol of absorption in the cosmos, that's the mudra that we sit with, where both hands are resting in the lap with palms up, left hand on top of the right hand, thumbs lightly touching. Apparently, it's called the symbol of absorption in the cosmos. Body and mind unmoving, eyes half open. You should see all compounded things as like dreams, illusions, bubbles, shadows. Don't get hung up in thought about them. Let's go back over this. Sitting straight means sitting cross-legged. The advantage of sitting cross-legged is that the extremities are drawn together. The feet are right, roughly near the center of the body. And when the limbs are drawn together like that, then the mind pulls together in concentration a little more easily. Body and mind unmoving. Well, if we can sit without moving, then it'll be easier to bring the mind to stillness. It's such a intimate connection between body and mind. It's just something that is, I think it's unique in Zen as far as the importance of posture, how we arrange ourselves, how we stand, how we sit, how we lie down, how we walk. It all determines the mind to a great extent. That's why posture is emphasized so much. To not move is to stay with what is. We're always trying to get away from what is. Certainly when what's happening is painful, we want to flee or fight it. We want to avoid ourselves in all kinds of ways. We're avoiding ourselves all the time. When we can't move, then we're facing ourselves. And that it is that facing oneself directly that is so revealing and so ultimately so liberating. But before it's liberating, it can be painful to put to rest our whole denial system, in which we actively avoid facing things about ourselves that really cause us pain day in and day out. By facing these things rather than denying them, by looking into, we face them not by thinking about them, but by concentrating on the practice, the breath of the koan. That is facing oneself. And in that process, that looking directly at our self nature, we have revealed for us both wonderful things and painful things. But if we can hold to that and not flee, mentally flee or physically, if we can just hold to that, then we come to see through these shadows of the mind that are anxiety-provoking, frightening, painful. So the not moving helps in not distracting our neighbors, but the more basic point of it is to not turn away from what is. Eyes half open. You should see all compounded things as like dreams, illusions, bubbles, shadows. In other words, to see all phenomena as having no abiding self-substance, no permanence, no substance. Seeing things as evanescent, seeing things as in flux. Certainly we see, when we sit still and look into the mind, we see the flux of the mind. We see, look at all of the things that we go through in a single round of sitting, thoughts and feelings, the fears, the emotions, the fantasies, the memories, the ideas of all kinds, the thoughts of the future. It's a riot in there. Everything moving, shifting, arising and passing away. And like bubbles breaking. Dreams. So don't get hung up in thought about them, because they're unreal. All of this theater of the mind. Question: crossing the legs and making the symbol with the hands is the comportment of the realized ones, but why keep the eyes half open? And then he answers, when the eyes are fully open and you can see for a distance, your mind can be distracted by the profusion of objects. Yet, if you close your eyes, you fall into a state of darkness and oblivion, and your mind is not clear. When your eyes are half open, Your thoughts don't race. Mind and body are one thusness. When you examine clearly, the afflictions of birth and death cannot be approached. This is called fulfilling Buddhahood right where you are, the meaning of great capacity and great function. Question. Though I hear what you say, it's still hard to really believe. Only by accumulating the virtues of reading and reciting sutras and dharani, fasting, discipline, and recitation of Buddha names can we have something to rely on. How can there be anything special about peaceful meditation without doing anything? Such doubts is called activity causing birth and death. Such doubt is called affliction. Practicing everything without any sense of attainment is called the exceedingly profound transcendent wisdom. This wisdom can cut off the source of birth and death like a sharp sword. To practice virtue in hopes of reward is the illusion of ordinary people. Bodhisattvas do not seek for the resulting rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue, because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion, and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. As for those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue and attain the lesser reward of humanity or godhood, this is surely the work of birth and death. Okay. That last sentence, as for those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue, this is the ordinary person. You do good in hopes of getting something out of it. At the very least, one can always count on feeling better about oneself, one's self-esteem being strengthened by doing good things. But, he says, this is still in the realm of birth and death, meaning still in the realm of evolving and devolving. It's still in the realm of the six worlds of unenlightened existence. According to Buddhist teaching, performing virtuous acts will gain us a rebirth as in one of the two highest of the six unenlightened realms of existence, the realms of humans and of heavenly beings. Heavenly beings being understood as a realm of unusual privilege and pleasure and ease. So doing good has its rewards. But what Langshi is saying here is, that, okay, good, so we get a rebirth as a human, which is our deva, which is a privileged, certainly is a privileged state of existence, to be born as a human and have the capacity to practice and see through all these realms. But still, it is, can't compare to the realm of the Buddhas, which is beyond these six realms. One might think, just imagining loosely, that the realm of the Buddhas is like heaven, but in Buddhism, it's different. It's a heavenly privileged existence is still subject to change. You still can fall from that privileged state. Whereas with enlightenment, one has transcended all that ladder, that ascending and descending ladder of going through different realms of unenlightened existence. And that's where this practice comes in. It's if we can reach a state of samadhi. Samadhi means with no thoughts in the mind, no goals, no sense of a self that's going to get any rewards from doing good things. If we can reach that realm, then we can be free. So he said, practicing everything without any sense of attainment is called the exceedingly profound transcendent wisdom. So when we are thoroughly absorbed in the breath or mu or the whatever our question is or practice is, when we're thoroughly absorbed beyond thought, then there's no sense of attainment in the mind. Attainment means a sense of destination or getting somewhere or having gotten somewhere. Question: without accumulating virtue and good qualities, how can one become a Buddha in whom myriad virtues are complete? And he says, it takes three incalculable eons to attain Buddhahood by accumulating virtue and good qualities. But if you practice the way of unity of cause and effect, you realize Buddhahood in one lifetime. Someone who illumines his own mind and awakens to his real nature sees that he himself is originally Buddha, not now attaining Buddhahood for the first time. So trying to pile up merit, spiritual merit through good deeds, is the long way to Buddhahood. It certainly does have its merits, but this, if we, it says, if you practice the way of unity of cause and effect, where you haven't split cause and effect. If I do this, then I'll get that. This is pure Zazen, the unity of cause and effect. Then we can realize instantly that we always have been enlightened. Cause and effect is just a dualistic concept. It's a way of understanding how reality functions. If we do this, that will result. But in truth, all dualisms, all dichotomies are constructed by our discriminating minds. There is a reality beyond the dualisms, beyond the dichotomies. In this realm, you can't separate cause and effect. Everything is at once both cause and effect. Every event, every experience, every phenomenon is simultaneously cause and effect. It's the cause of a future effect, and it's the effect of a previous cause. In the Hakuin chant, he says, then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. There's something I skipped here. I meant to say this passage, referring to bodhisattvas, that ordinary people practice virtue in hopes of reward. Bodhisattvas do not seek for the resulting rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue, because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. It's when we have this this pure action without any thought of reward that this becomes sustenance for enlightenment. And there is a passage here about this that I'm going to read by another Chinese master. This is actually not a Chan master, Zen master, but a Buddhist master from the Huayan school of Buddhism, in commenting on the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Avatamsaka Sutra is the core scripture in the Huayan school, or the Avatamsaka school of Buddhism. And don't ask me what that is exactly, but it's a major school of Buddhism that has a lot of overlap with Zen. And this is what he said in this commentary. Since the aspiration to enlightenment is not learned or cultivated, the aspiration to enlightenment is always clearly self-evident as long as we carry out enlightening practices to quell habit energy. Let's just stop there for a second. The aspiration to enlightenment. Roshi Kaplan once said, each of us has taken a vow eons and eons and eons ago, beyond time. This is the same vow that an acorn takes to become an oak tree, a peach stone takes to become a peach, same vow that a child takes to become an adult. For us, to be human means to, at some, it means to be wired for enlightenment. We are designed to awaken to what we already are, because that's what we are. So of course, this is our design. Enlightenment. For most people, this program within us is not a conscious thing. Most people don't articulate in the mind enlightenment or an aspiration to enlightenment, partly because most people in the world have never heard of it. If more people would hear of it, well, there might be more who would then aspire to awaken to their original enlightenment. But this is our nature. It's like a flower turning toward the light. It's not that there is an intention in any kind of conscious way. It's just what flowers do. They turn toward the light. Humans turn toward enlightenment. The great privilege of finding this path is that we can now be conscious of it. We can go about finding our way back to what we are. So the aspiration to enlightenment, sometimes it's called the thought of enlightenment. It is an extraordinary, extraordinary point in our evolution over lifetimes and lifetimes, to conceive of the possibility of awakening from a dream of this world with all of its ups and downs, its successes and failures, its pains and joys. So back to what I read already. Since the aspiration to enlightenment is not learned or cultivated, it is always clearly self-evident as long as we carry out enlightening practices to quell habit energy. Habit energy refers to our habits in the direction of greed, anger, and delusion. It is as when clouds disperse in the sky. The sky is itself clear, so there is no further search for clear sky. Just carry out the myriad practices of compassion and wisdom as means of stabilizing enlightenment. If any practice is not understood or not carried out, or if there is any grasping and rejecting, then there is an obstacle. And so the aspiration to enlightenment is not in its complete state, since enlightening action is itself the aspiration to enlightenment. Enlightening action is acting or speaking without self-attachment. So to just carry out the many practices of compassion and wisdom, that is affirming, honoring our true nature in action, doing it, enacting our true nature by going with our capacity for compassionate acts and wisdom. This is itself the enacting of the aspiration to enlightenment. And then a little more here. So once Sudana had awakened the aspiration to enlightenment, he asked Manjusri how to learn to act as an enlightening being and practice the path of enlightening beings. He asked no more about the aspiration to enlightenment. So, to translate this in terms of ourselves, to find practice, to conceive of the possibility of freeing ourselves from our ignorance, then that we reach the point where we get practical. Okay, how do we put this into practice? We no longer have to concern ourselves with this realm that's called enlightenment, but rather how to act, how to refrain from acting. And this is where the precepts come in. The precepts describe our enlightened nature. So the more we can uphold, live up to the precepts, the more we're bearing or upholding our enlightened nature. And then the questioner, do those who realize Buddhahood by seeing reality not depend on cause and effect? Should they not cultivate virtue? And then the answer, although those who realize Buddhahood by seeing their true nature may cultivate virtue, they do it for others' benefit, not for their own rewards. Because they teach and transform sentient beings, they teach cause and effect. Because they know they have no personal gain, they do not depend on merit. They have no mind at all. No mind of getting and giving and getting. Awakening reveals that you can't, that you as an individual cannot get something without others getting it. That the idea of gaining something is meaningless in terms of self and other. And this enables us to act with a big picture, the sense of doing things for the greater good, for the larger benefit of all beings, not just oneself. Question, what is no mind? If there is no mind at all, who sees reality? Who awakens to the way? And who can expound the way to teach? And then this is something of a semantic clarification by Langshi. He says, no mind means that there is no deluded, foolish mind. It does not mean there is no mind to discern false from true. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, doesn't long for Buddhas either, in other words, doesn't divide the world into the enlightened and the unenlightened, doesn't think of illusion or seek enlightenment, doesn't go along with the honor of others, does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation, does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile, and does not add any discriminating thoughts about any good or evil, one is called a no-minded traveler. Wayfarer is the word that's used here. Just meaning someone on the path, sometimes called seeker. A no-minded seeker, let's say. Question, are there differences of more or less merit in fasting, observing the precepts, reading and reciting sutras and dharani, and chanting Buddha names? So this questioner is still trying to do the accounting here. Okay, if I fast, that'll get me how much merit as compared to upholding the precepts and maybe mixing in some reciting sutras and just wanting to add it all up. Yeah. But he says, eating once a day removes greed for food and results in great blessings and virtue in the coming life. What he's doing here now is he's itemizing the different kinds of actions that are considered merit acquiring actions, good deeds. These are the different practices, Buddhist practices, that are honored and respected and cultivated in many kinds of Buddhism. And they're not completely absent in Zen either. So he's saying what the rewards are for these things. Eating does that. Results in great blessings and virtue in the coming life. I mean, fasting. Eating once a day. And then morality and discipline is also to stop bad states of mind and produce a good mental state. Those with good minds live in human and heavenly realms, in the highest estates. This is what we mentioned earlier, the highest realms of unenlightened existence. Those who read the sutras protect and maintain the teachings of the enlightened ones. These people will have great knowledge and wisdom in the coming life. No mind is the Buddha mind. The qualities of this enlightened mind cannot be reached by words or thought. It is truly inconceivable. So again, this Buddha mind of ours, this original mind, has no traces of any of this, doing this and getting that, giving this and receiving that, rewards, cause and effect. It's unstained by this whole structure, this conceptual structure of gain and loss. It's just who we are, this Buddha nature. We can't gain it, because it's who we are and have always been. It's not in the realm of gain and loss, evolving and devolving. This is the other side of reality. Most people know only the world of phenomena, mental phenomena, structures like this, concepts, words, stages, ascending, descending, success, failure, all these things, enlightenment, delusion. That's just half of things as they are. That's all created by us. We generate all those concepts. We find words for them. And then we talk about the reality in terms of those things. But that's just one aspect of it. The other is beyond such words, beyond thought, beyond concepts, undivided. Question. Such roots of goodness as these each have their merit, undoubtedly, but what is the virtue of no-mindedness? He says, learning the standards of conduct of the Buddha, transmitting the sayings of the Buddha, and extolling the names of the Buddha have merit, so mindless wayfarers, no-minded practitioners, must also have merit. If you say no mind has no, if you say no mind has no merit, then other practices cannot have any merit either. All roots of virtue and good qualities are conditional, whether they be heavenly or humanly mundane. No mind, on the other hand, is immediate witness of the path of enlightenment, so its merit cannot be adequately expressed in words. Really, it is the condition of the one great matter. The afflictions of birth and death die away of themselves. Mind and body are one thusness. This is what it is. How can there be any doubt about the immediate mind realizing Buddhahood? It's in a way, it's futile. It's futile to talk about this realm of no mind. I guess, why do we talk about it? Why do teachers talk about it? Maybe because so that one can, if one can through one's own direct experience, reach that realm in meditation, then one can have some familiarity with it. But it has to be experienced. You can get a mental picture of it. You can sort of imagine. You can imagine what this realm is that's beyond all conditions, beyond all discrimination. But that's not much just to imagine it or conceive of it. To experience it for oneself, this is what is so illuminating, so inspiring, so transforming, is to experience that realm for oneself. And that's where the practice comes in. Although teachers in Zen do talk some about this, all this stuff, it's only to encourage students to experience these things for themselves. That's where the money is, the direct experience of it. And it is through the simple practice that we're doing, whatever one's particular practice is, that is the portal, the gateway to realizing this realm which is a realm of absolute freedom. What it takes to reach that realm is absolute single-minded absorption in the practice. Thoroughly losing oneself in that breath, in that koan. And then there is no self and other. There is no tunas. That's it. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.